Today on the Errata Movie Podcast, we have a report from the Sundance Film Festival.
Which celebrities you saw and who you partied with. So give us the dirt.
Strangely, I did not even go to a single party this year.
Oh, Rob!
This is Robert Davis. I know we're actually a little behind on the stuff that we had planned to push out into the podcast, and one of the biggest reasons for that is the Sundance Film Festival, which is the last couple of weeks of January every year. And so we decided that instead of pretending like that didn't delay everything we were planning, we'll just talk about Sundance. So today we have two reports from the Sundance Film Festival. First, there's mine, and I'll talk about some of my favorite movies. And then joining us a little bit later to talk about a different side of the festival is blogger and film writer Brian Darr. Now, as we talk about these movies, we're going to try not to give away any spoilers. But of course, there may be minor spoilers just as we talk about what the movies are about. Now, if you're a subscriber to this podcast, then you have access to the enhanced version, which has chapter stops and little pictures and links with each chapter. So if we start talking about something that you don't want to hear about, you can just hit next on your iPod or iTunes, and it'll jump to the next chapter. And joining me, as always, here's J. Robert Parks.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Hey, J. Robert. Good.
You just gotten back from Sundance, and where I understand from your wonderful blogging that it was kind of cold in Utah this year.
It is. It is always cold in Park City, Utah. It's this little town of, 5,000 or 6,000 people. It's a resort town, so there are lots of ski runs and ski lifts right out of Main Street. And yet this one time of year, it's inundated by 50,000 people, and it's just a big, cold, slushy mess. And this year was no different.
Let me start with what I know is your most anticipated film at Sundance, that you were looking forward to, a movie called Sugar, that was directed by the same people who did Half Nelson. And did it live up to your hopes and dreams?
I think it did, yeah. Half Nelson is one of my favorite movies of the last few years. And I had it at the top of my list last year, and it was made by these first-time filmmakers. And it was just amazing because it was so rich on so many levels. And so when I saw that they had another movie that they had completed and was in this year's Sundance, that was my most anticipated movie, which is a little bit unusual because going into Sundance, Sundance is a festival that really focuses on brand new or emerging filmmakers. And so unlike, say, Toronto, where, you know, I want to see the 10 films by international masters that I know are going to be interesting, at Sundance, it's a lot of times a crapshoot. So I was a little nervous about having a film that I actually anticipated or was hoping would be good, and it was called Sugar, and I'm glad to say that it was really great.
Now, what's it about?
It's about, it's a fiction film about a baseball player from the Dominican Republic who wants nothing more than to be a major league baseball player in the U.S., and he enters the minor league system, comes to the U.S. for the first time, doesn't speak English, doesn't really know anything about the culture, and discovers those things when he's here. And it sounds like maybe the type of baseball movie we've seen many times before. And yet, as you'd expect from the people who made Half Nelson, it's really a lot more just about this character and about his loneliness that he experiences when he comes to the U.S. And confusion about whether this is what he wants to do. And it's much more interested in his happiness and satisfaction than it is him becoming a star. And so it's just a really beautiful movie. Very quiet, understated, character-focused drama.
Is there any sort of allegory or allusions to Hollywood in that way? You know, sort of avoiding being the star and just finding satisfaction in small things, or am I reading too much into your description?
You know, that's a possibility. I don't know. Certainly, they sort of did something similar with Half Nelson, which was about a teacher, a white teacher, who teaches in inner city Brooklyn, has an all-black class, and is going to inspire them. You know, this feels like, oh, something we've seen a million times before.
Yeah.
And yet it was very much about the fact that we've seen this a million times before and about how this teacher felt impotent that he couldn't do anything, because in real life, it doesn't really work that way. And so they were aware of their Hollywood model, and they were choosing realism over mm-hmm. that, you know? And yep. so I think in some ways that's true of Sugar also. They're certainly mm-hmm. aware of baseball movies that have been made, but I've never yeah. seen any that looked at it like this, you know? Mm-hmm. And this isn't even really so much about baseball, although I was able to talk to them, and Ryan Fleck told me that he's a baseball fan, and so that's one of the reasons he was so curious about this. Mm. And yet it's not even necessarily a baseball movie, you know?
Okay. Were there any other interesting tidbits for the interview, or do we have to wait for it to appear in Paste?
Well, it was, I asked them if they felt like this film had a political, if this was a political film, because certainly Half Nelson was, and this movie not as much. And they said that they felt like they're interested in giving their characters a social context because they don't exist in a void. That we all exist within the social context. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we're, quote, political people, you know. Right. The character in Half Nelson was very interested in politics, and therefore he talked about it a lot and vocalized it. And the character in Sugar, who goes by the nickname of Sugar, but his name is Miguel, he's certainly also in a very political world, and he feels the effects of it, but he doesn't necessarily think about it a lot or have a dialogue about it or talk about it because it isn't his interest, you know? And so I thought that was an interesting way to look at it, that as far as they're concerned, it's the character that matters more, but that they're fully aware and communicating to us the world that he's in.
That's nice. Another movie that I know you were looking forward to because of the director's previous work was The Visitor, directed by Thomas McCarthy, who did The Station Agent, which I know both you and I like. And how does that measure up?
Yeah, The Station Agent, another gentle comedy. Or sorry, not comedy, a gentle movie about a guy.
Oh, there's a lot of comic elements in that film.
That's true, there is. It's not a movie that I've loved, but I remember mm-hmm. enjoying it a lot, and I wouldn't mind mm-hmm. actually to see it again. This movie grabbed me a lot more than that did. You know, the interesting thing about Sundance this year is I saw several of these low-key character-based dramas, Sugar and The Visitor, and yet they're all very different. The Visitor is a lot more accessible than something like Sugar or some of the others that I saw. I could recommend it to lots of people because it's just a beautiful story about an economics professor who's a widower and seems disinterested in his academic work and would like to find something else. He's trying to learn to play the piano at the beginning of the movie, and is just sort of looking for something else in life, and he finds himself in New York to present a paper and stumbles into some other people's lives, people who are immigrants but have some common interests, which is a surprise to him and a surprise maybe in the story. And the way it's hard to talk about this movie without giving away sort of the direction that it goes, but I think that's the beauty of it, is it just is mm-hmm. willing to meander and let this guy find himself and find other people in the process.
Now I know another one of the character-based movies or character-driven movies that you really liked was Mama's Man, directed by the son of the great avant-garde filmmaker Ken Jacobs. And apparently it takes events from his real life and it's shot at his real childhood home. Is that right?
Yeah, the writer and director Aza Jacobs he cast his parents as the parents of this guy in the movie, and he shot it in their home, which was also his childhood home. And it's this apartment in New York that seems like it was made for cinema. I mean, it's this cluttered loft-like apartment that just has all these little nooks and crannies and things to see. And he gives you just a really good sense of the space. It's a really masterful movie. I mean, it shows a lot of skill in the way he lets this place seem very disorienting to us at first, but then gradually helps us understand where things are in relation to each other. Because the guy in the story has gone back to visit his parents for a few days. From California, he goes to New York and he's there for a business conference or something. And he stays in his old room and he meets with his parents and then he just never leaves. He has a wife and a new baby back in California. But he just, for some reason, doesn't go back. He keeps sort of wallowing in his old life, and it's about his attempts to sort of get out of that and get back to his back to his real world. It's a fascinating little bubble of a movie.
I'll be honest. Sometimes that kind of personal pseudo fiction makes me itch. I don't know. It just always feels a bit too reality-like to me. But this must rise above that, then.
Yeah, this is not this filmmaker's story. He was able to cast his parents, and it's a really tender portrait of them, as well as a character study of the main character. But he's not this guy. I think there are elements of his life in the story, but this isn't his story.
Oh, okay. Alrighty. And there was a fourth movie that I know you particularly liked, and which one was that?
This was a movie called Ballast. And I had the good fortune of walking into this movie completely blind. I had no idea what it was, who was in it, when it was made, where it was made, nothing about it at all. In fact, I'm not sure why it was there. Something, you know, I often like to get just a sense of something and then go and get the rest of it there, and that's what happened. And it didn't take long before I realized, wow, this seems influenced by La Promesse and Le Fils and L'Enfant, these great movies by the Dardennes, Belgian filmmakers who are working in this super realistic mode that is very humanist and touching. And I've never seen an American filmmaker do that. This is feels like their movies, and yet the people are speaking English, and they live in Mississippi. And it's a story that takes place in the Mississippi Delta, but it unfolds like a Dardenne film and has the same sensitivity to character and social class and poverty that their films do. And it's a really great first film by a guy named Lance Hammer.
That's something to look forward to. Now, these four films, I assume the first two we talked about, Sugar and The Visitor, have some kind of distribution lined up. But how about the others? Well, are we likely to see these in art house theaters sometime this year?
I think that although I put all four of these in sort of a similar category of the low-key character-based dramas, they're really very different. And The Visitor, if it doesn't have distribution, I think it probably will. Actually, it does. It does have distribution. And as I go down the list, Sugar is likely to, Mama's Man is not likely to, and Ballast, I'd be very surprised. They'll get international distribution, and they'll be seen in bigger cities, but they're in some ways too rigorous I think, probably even an art house distribution in some ways. I mean, even the Dardennes, which are internationally known, get very small distribution in this country. Yeah. So
it's a good point. It's a good point.
Yeah.
So I was intrigued by one of your blog posts, where this movie called Baghead, where you described it as a combination of low-budget horror and mumblecore. And I didn't think that combination was possible. So how does this work?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't sure it was possible either, but it begins as a parody of these mumblecore movies. I don't know if everyone who's listening necessarily knows about this this sort of movement. There are a few filmmakers who have, with very modest equipment, made these films with their friends that are sort of very true to their own lives. You know, they cast themselves and their friends in these movies. Joe Swanberg is one, and Andrew Bajalski is another guy who's known for this. And they make these really nice dramas. It's almost too much to call them a drama, because there's very little plot. Even it's, you know, people hanging around, and it's mumblecore is the name that someone has given these movies. Baghead begins as a parody of those movies. It's four friends who go to a film festival and are watching one of these mumblecore movies and watching the Q&A afterward, which is hilarious for anyone who's ever attended a Q&A at a film festival. What was your budget? You know, all these questions that we've heard a million times. And they decide, hey, we could make a movie like this. We're actors. We never get any jobs. You know what we need to do? We need to write our own movie and make our own movie. And so they go out to a cabin in the woods and think, we're going to spend a weekend and write a screenplay for us. And so it's very funny and sharp. And it's in the style of mumblecore and yet making fun of mumblecore at the same time, which is funny. And then once they get out there, the cabin in the woods, you realize, hey, cabin in the woods, I've heard of that story before too. And then for a while I can't figure out, is this a funny movie or a scary movie? Because I'm starting to get a little creeped out. It's really very effective. And I don't know what the status of this movie is, but I really hope that it finds its way into theaters, because it's fun, and I think I could recommend it to a lot of people.
Oh, that's good. That does sound like fun. Now, Sundance screens a lot of fiction films, but they also screen a lot of documentaries. How many of those did you get a chance to see, and which ones should we particularly be looking out for?
I probably saw close to a dozen documentaries. I don't remember the count, but there were a couple that really stood out as really very good. One was called Man on Wire. One thing about Sundance is that it's very much an American film festival. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have a world cinema category, and they bring lots of international films too. But the strong films are typically the American films, and even the international films sometimes seem to be selected because they reflect America in some ways. Like In the Shadow of the Moon from last mm-hmm. year was actually a film made in the UK, but it's about obviously the U.S. moon landing. Mm-hmm. Or The Short Life of Jose Antonio Gutierrez is a film from Germany, I believe, and yet it's about American immigration and military. So lots of these sort of international films are that way. And this is probably another one of those. This is Man on Wire, which is a film from the UK about a French wire walker named Philippe Petit. And he, when he was young, he read about the World Trade Center towers being built. And he had this sudden desire to string a wire between them and walk across it as if they were being built for him. Well, he was young and they were going to take many, many years to be built. And so in the meantime, he did these stunts. He strung a wire between the towers of Notre Dame Cathedral and walked across it, and crowds gathered and he got arrested. And he did the same thing in Australia. And then finally the World Trade Center towers were built. And this film documents this stunt like it's a bank heist. A fairly difficult engineering problem to sneak into the World Trade Center. He does this stuff without permission. Sneak into the World Trade Center, string a cable between the two towers, try to figure out how you would do that. And we're talking at the top, we're not at the 10th floor or something like that, but way up there. And then without any sort of cable or tether or net or anything, he steps out onto this wire, walks across it, and does acrobatics. It's stunning, but it also feels like, you know, this achievement and this, like, it's energetically told, and it's just a really, really fun, fun movie. And I heard a lot of people say that it was their favorite of the festival.
Now that happened, what, 30 years ago though, right?
That was 1974, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So is it like interviews with people today, or what sort of footage do they have in this documentary?
They have lots of footage of this guy, both doing this and the other stunts that he did, and also just as a juggler in Paris. And they have present day interviews with everybody. He himself, he's a really energetic guy who loves to tell this story, you can tell. But then he also had a crew of people helping him, because he had tons of equipment he had to get up there, and there were some people on the inside and some people on the outside, and he had people on the ground, you know, helping him out. So they all are interviewed too about how scared they were, and how it's just
I remember that when it happened. I was young, like, I guess I was about 7, and I remember thinking, I knew nothing about the World Trade Center, but I saw the footage on the news, and it's like, wow, that's something. And so the first time I went to the top of the World Trade Center, that was one of the first things I thought of, was how did this guy do this? Because not only are you way up there, but you know, you've got this wind. I mean, you've got, you've got the buildings themselves are swaying, and you have, I just can't imagine the sort of person who would do that.
I know. Well, he's the guy who this movie is about. And so that's what makes it very entertaining.
Oh, well, that sounds like fun. How about some other documentaries that are worth seeing?
Well, another one that was good was called Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. It's about filmmaker Roman Polanski, who he was nominated for an Academy Award for The Pianist a few years ago. And I remember when that was nominated and then eventually won, there was talk about how he would not be at the ceremony, because if he came to the U.S., he would be arrested, because he was convicted of having sex with a minor decades ago, and fled the country to avoid being put in jail. I never knew any of the details of this, but I knew that story. It's kind of a story that has scarred his reputation.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and it's lurid, and so people like to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, and he's a great filmmaker who made movies like Knife in the Water and Chinatown and Rosemary's Baby all before he left. And then since then, he's made, of course, The Pianist, which was a good movie. And this is just a very detailed, methodical, thorough look at his life up to that point, and the case, the trial. And and does give you a different perspective, gave me anyway, a different perspective on the guy and all that that happened. It doesn't pretend like he wasn't guilty of this. But there were a lot of things about the story that were very interesting about his life up to that point. His parents were killed by Nazis, and he managed to get away and rebuild his life in the U.S. as a successful filmmaker. And then his wife, Sharon Tate, who was pregnant with their child, was killed by followers of Charles Manson in this, crazy, another story that was all over the newspapers. So he's had a very strange life. Not that it excuses anything that he may have done, but all of that sort of sets the scene for a very weird trial as well. So anyway, it's a very, very interesting movie.
Again, a lot of talking head interviews, or what's the approach?
Yeah, it's talking head interviews. So in a lot of ways, it's a traditional film, but it has lots of footage of him, and it integrates footage of him plus footage from his films into the story in really clever ways, and it's a very engaging movie. What I heard is that before the movie was over, Harvey Weinstein was on the phone saying, "We're going to buy this movie." So I think the Weinstein Company bought the international rights, and HBO has bought the rights in the U.S. and may release it in theaters, or it may just be on HBO. Mm-hmm. But either way, it's going to be seen.
Okay. Sundance is a festival that gives out prizes. It seems to me that Sundance's prizes are more dubious than other festivals. I don't know why that feels that way, but I think we should at least mention some of the winners. Which films went home with hardware this year?
Yeah, you're right. They have these juries that choose winners, and a jury of just a handful of people who are sort of picking their favorites. And I don't know exactly what they're looking for necessarily. A lot of it depends on who the people are. This year it was people like Quentin Tarantino.
Oh.
And Eugene Jarecki and Lucretia Mortel and Amir Barlev. So good filmmakers.
Yep.
But a lot of times I wonder if they're looking for something that didn't get noticed by, who knows what they're looking for. But the winners this year were in the dramatic American category, Frozen River.
I don't remember you mentioning that one.
No, it was not a favorite of mine, although in the competition category, a couple of my favorites were in there, but a couple of my least favorites were in there too. So they could have done much worse. They chose something that I think was probably in the middle for me. It's going to be coming out on Sony Pictures Classics, and it's a movie about a woman in rural New York who lives near a Native American reservation, finds herself involved in a smuggling ring. I don't know why I'm laughing. It's not funny. I don't know. It's a little overly dramatic, I suppose. It's fine. It's not a great or not a bad movie. The winner in the World Cinema Dramatic category was a nice little drama called King of Ping Pong. It's from Sweden. At first I thought it was going to be something a little like Napoleon Dynamite, because it seems like it's going to be this quirky little comedy about this guy who is really into ping pong, and he sort of... He's the king of ping pong in his little town. He goes to the community center and he towers over all the little kids who are there, and he teaches them, the importance of ping pong. But it actually turns out to be a nice little drama about this guy, his brother, their mother, and then the idea of their father, who is not there, and they sort of know who he is, but they don't know him well. And it was a different kind of movie than I expected. It sounds very silly, but it's not. I think it's a fine choice, actually, for the jury. It's not one of my favorite movies of the festival, but I thought it was a nice movie. For the American documentary, the winner was Trouble the Water, which is a documentary I did not get to see, unfortunately, but I heard that it was good for many people. It's made by a woman who was trapped in her attic during the floods of New Orleans.
Oh, and made by her or made about
by her?
Her
and caught, she caught this on videotape and made a movie out of it. And so it sounds really interesting, but I didn't get to see it. And in the World Cinema documentary category, the winner was Man on Wire.
Which
we talked about.
Oh, good. Good. Well, it sounds like good awards this year then.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a couple are mediocre, but, or at least one of them was, but yeah.
Yeah, that's not a bad batting average for Sundance, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Well, now we gotta switch gears, and we have to do the category of we wouldn't know how good something was unless we saw something this bad. So what were the worst films you saw?
Well, I should never say this is the worst movie I've seen at Sundance so far, because that's guaranteed to make me see a couple more that rival it. I saw a movie fairly early on in the festival called Good Dick, which is just the most ridiculous movie. Nothing makes any sense, and yet it fits this sort of Sundance mold. There's this type of movie that shows up every year in numbers at Sundance, which is about a person who's sort of a loner, troubled loner, and who meets a perky individual who is going to bring them out of their shell, and we have to wait for this shell to be cracked and see them get together, and it's just excruciating to me. Sometimes it's done better than others, and in this movie, I don't think it could have been done much worse. Mm. But then I saw another film called Pretty Bird, and the reason I went to see Pretty Bird was it stars Paul Giamatti and Billy Crudup and Kristen Wiig from Saturday Night Live, and it was directed by Paul Schneider, who is an actor who's been in David Gordon Green's films, and he was Lars and the Real Girl with Ryan Gosling, and he was quite good in that.
Yes, he was.
But this is the first movie he's directed, and unfortunately, I don't think he has taken a lot of lessons from David Gordon Green, his buddy. Mm. these are three very likable actors, which made me want to follow this movie for quite a while. For a good 30 minutes, I was thinking, boy, I hope these characters are... I want to be smiling and laughing at them. And yet it just becomes so... it goes so far off the rails, I'm not really sure what they were thinking. Characters are no longer behaving in a way that we even recognize. Like, suddenly this guy is mean and angry, and I don't know where that came from, or now what's happening, I don't understand why they care about this, or it was... I'm not sure how it got this far. I'm not even going to bother to explain the plot. So there are always a few bad movies, but you're right. They're just in contrast to the ones that were actually really good.
No, and I'm only being half facetious when I say that. When we go to Toronto and we see, maybe 40 films in 10 days, it's sometimes helpful to see one or two really bad movies, because after a while I start thinking, am I liking everything because it's the glow of the festival? Mm. And then you see something really bad and you go, oh, no. I've just gotten lucky this year. There were a lot of good movies.
Yeah.
And here's the bad one that reminds me of what certain movies can be like. So, well, we have, I know that for some of our readers, for some of our listeners, they really weren't so interested in the movies, Rob. They've been waiting to hear about which celebrities you saw and who you partied with. So give us the dirt.
Strangely, I did not even go to a single party this year.
Oh, Rob, fatherhood has killed you.
Yeah, usually I end up at one party, and this year I was too tired even for that. The one party that I was going to go to, it was on a day that I had already seen six movies, and I thought, you know what? I'd rather go to bed.
Oh, that's a long day.
I did see Tom Arnold walking past me at one point. How about that?
There you go.
Yeah.
And you did some interviews too, though, and you mentioned a couple of them, but who else did you interview this year?
I'm very glad that I was able to talk to the directors of all four of my favorite movies at the festival.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Lance Hammer, who directed Ballast, Aza Jacobs, who directed Mama's Man, Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, who directed Sugar, and Thomas McCarthy, who directed The Visitor. And he's also an actor in the popular HBO series The Wire, which everyone is telling me to watch, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, me too. And that's everyone tells me that it's the best thing out there. And I don't have HBO, so I'd have to rent it on DVD. And as you know, I don't really watch DVDs.
Yeah.
Well, Rob, I'm a little disappointed that the best you can come up with is Tom Arnold.
I was thinking that late in the fest too. But boy, what? I haven't collected very good stories this year.
We're gonna have to sort of slip some booze into whatever you're drinking and get you moving somewhere else at Sundance. Well, no, that's anything else? Any non-celebrity stories that are worth telling? Anything that was different this year about Sundance that you thought was interesting or?
Well, from a business perspective, I kept hearing, especially early on, that it was a real disappointment because I think a lot of distributors and studios came into the festival knowing that the writer's strike is still going on, the directors may strike. And so although feature films are not affected as immediately as TV is in that situation, they know that the pipeline may be thinning. Mm-hmm. And so they came primed to buy movies. And yet the best movies at this festival were these low-key dramas that don't sell.
Yeah, right.
I actually got a real kick out of that because these were great movies. But I understand that people who were looking for big crowd pleasers were somewhat disappointed. So we'll see.
I find it funny that in most coverage of Sundance, even by respected newspapers, you know, even the New York Times, those kinds of issues are what dominate. In other words, people don't really talk that much about the films themselves. They talk about whether the films will sell. And I think that's always turned me off a bit about Sundance and why I have friends who say, don't you want to go to Sundance? I'm like, no, I don't really feel like going, because for me, it feels like a business festival, you know, a festival for buyers. But it sounds like this year that it was a great festival for people who just want to watch and talk about movies.
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, I definitely feel that when I'm at Sundance as well, that it's very businessy. And I spend the first 8 days in press and industry screenings surrounded by that sort of thing. And then the last day and a half or so I spend in public screenings, and it's just such a different vibe. People are very, just want to enjoy movies. But at the same time, that's when I run into people who say, oh, I just saw the worst movie I've ever seen in my life. It's called Ballast. And I say, no. I know it has no music, and I know it's all this handheld camera, and it doesn't have this big crescendo at the end. But man, it's a great movie. So yeah, that's all right.
No, but that's true of almost any festival. You know, when I go to Chicago Festival, and even when I go to Toronto, although Toronto has a pretty, you know, sophisticated audience, still you will talk to people who, you know, loved the movie you hated and hated the movie you loved. So
yeah, and everybody has their own taste. Yeah, that's fine.
Absolutely. And that for me is part of the fun of festival going, is having those conversations and those interactions, and you know, getting a sense of how people look at certain things and why they like certain things. I find that, you know, really fun, and those conversations fascinating.
Yeah, in fact, the woman who told me that was her least favorite film, whenever I said, oh, I love that movie, her eyes lit up and she said, how interesting. And then she wanted to talk about why. And so that was great. It wasn't just a sort of sneering of the nose, you know, it was a, hey, let's talk about that. So I enjoyed that too.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great. Any final thoughts? I know that oftentimes pundits will go to Sundance and try to predict where American cinema is going. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I was really pleased that the day after I sort of wrote up this little blog entry about my four favorite movies, how they were these nice little low-key comedy or dramas. Manola Dargis in the New York Times had already come up with a name for three of those four, and she called it the New American Realism. So I was very glad that someone had sort of noticed. You know, who knows how these trends happen. To me, it feels like I don't know if certain filmmakers are all responding to the same thing, or if it's just you know, a complete coincidence that these four movies happened at the same time. I know that from talking to Azza Jacobs that he was inspired by Half Nelson a couple of years ago, and although Mama's Man doesn't have anything to do with Half Nelson, the sense of filmmaking that it got from them really inspired him to do something serious and real and good. And he actually shares the producer with Sugar. And The Visitor, I was intrigued by the title of The Visitor because it reminds me so much of L'Enfant, the child, this Dardenne film. And the cool thing about that title is it's not clear who the child is, and it changes from scene to scene. You could think, oh, maybe that's the child. Oh, here's the child. And the same is true of The Visitor. Throughout the movie, it's like, oh, that person's a visitor now. Things have changed, and then we've got someone visiting. And I asked Thomas McCarthy about that, and he said exactly that he was thinking of the Dardennes. He loves those guys, and he would never answer the question of who is the visitor. So it's fun to see that they're all aware of each other, and whether this is a movement that we can give a name, I don't know. But I'm so excited to see it happening.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I certainly appreciated your blog coverage. It was just fun to look at that every day, and it was fun to see that you were seeing a lot of movies that you liked. That's always exciting for someone who's thinking, I wonder what's happening in 6 months or 9 months or 12 months. So a lot of good stuff to look forward to.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you liked it.
Sundance is probably best known as a marketplace for films that are hoping to find their way into your local movie theater. But the full program is actually quite a bit broader than that. And here to talk about that other side of Sundance is blogger and film writer Brian Darr. Brian has his own blog called Hell on Frisco Bay, and he was covering Sundance for Green Scene Daily, which you can find if you point your web browser to daily.greencine.com. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Rob. Good to see you again.
One thing I like about your approach to movies was actually something about last year. Last year, we were both at Sundance also, and I didn't run into you that many times, but at the end of the festival, when we were back, I asked you what you thought, and this is paraphrasing, but you said something like, well, it was fun to go see friends, but I think for just the movies, it probably would have been better to stay in San Francisco.
That's definitely true. Last year, I probably shouldn't tease the listeners and tell them all the things. Well, I'm just as jealous that I missed all these, you know, Jodorowsky and Altman and Lubitsch films that played while we were in Sundance. And I enjoyed a lot of the films I saw last year, especially some of the documentaries. But I was kind of regretful afterwards that I'd missed all this great cinephile catnip.
Well, it says something about like an average day in San Francisco at the movies, but also I think it says something about your approach to the movies at Sundance.
Yeah, I focus more on trying to see the things that I don't expect. I definitely will have a chance to see things that aren't necessarily going to get released. Documentaries, Frontier, the New Frontier programs, which are along the experimental side of things.
Feature films, but they're sort of an avant-garde bent.
Right,
yeah,
exactly. And this year I saw Edward II, which is from their from the Sundance Collection series of films, where they bring back a couple, every year, a couple films that had played Sundance of years past.
Yeah, like when did that play?
That played in 1992, I believe. And I'd never seen any Derek Jarman feature film before, which is maybe kind of weird living in San Francisco, but actually doesn't get revived that often, at least these days.
Yeah, I don't think I have either.
And I'd heard of Edward II back when it first came out, and I was, you know, just out of high school, and I thought it was a sequel to Edward Scissorhands. But I was always
Where's Johnny Depp? They couldn't get Johnny Depp back.
No Johnny Depp. No.
Tilda Swinton now.
Instead, yes, Tilda Swinton. And it was really, it kind of set the tone for the festival in some ways to see this film. Well, for one, my friend who watched it with me, that who was my host at the festival, he hated it. So we were able to argue about it left and right throughout the rest of the week.
Now, the reason they were showing that film, or at least one reason, was that there's a new documentary about Derek Jarman at the festival, which I think you caught also?
Yes. Yeah, once I saw Edward II, I really wanted to see this Derek documentary, which luckily had one final screening I was able to attend. And it was actually ended up being my favorite documentary of the festival. There's something about a documentary on a filmmaker that I just barely know. Now, perhaps somebody who knows him well would find all sorts of faults in the approach, but they were able to structure the film based on two documents. One is this kind of an open letter written by Tilda Swinton in 2002, reminiscing on her collaborator on Caravaggio, The Last of England, Edward II, and other films. Just talking about how he's so missed after his death in 1994. And the other is I believe it was 14 hours of interview footage between Jarman and Colin McCabe in 1990. And so they used voiceover of both this interview and visual clips from this interview. They also had voiceover from Tilda Swinton reading aloud the letter that she wrote in 2002. Then they had all this incredible archival footage of, you know, Super 8 films growing up, spending time in San Francisco, New York City, among the underground filmmaker and kind of beat poet scenes in the 60s, up through all the films that he made. Clips from all of his films were shown. Well, I don't know about all of them, but a lot of them. And I don't know how to exactly put it, but they all added up to something that I found very moving. It was just seeing this artistic force that I hadn't really understood the impact of, all condensed into this one film, made me feel, I don't know, inspired that there can be, in such a short period, such a short lifespan, somebody who can have such an impact on the creative direction of a national cinema or the world cinema.
I'm sure it made you want to seek out his films too.
Yes, yeah, I definitely want to see more of his films after seeing just one and the documentary.
So what else did you see that you liked?
I really liked, well, a couple that you had pointed me to. Ballast, for example, I thought was tremendous. And you maybe you've already talked about this before.
I mentioned it as one of my faves, but I'm glad to hear that someone else liked it too. Sometimes, you know, you see something, I feel like, is it just me? Was it my mood? Was it, I don't know, but I'm, you know.
It's such a confident film. Like, the filmmaker, clearly he'd been in that region and really soaking up an atmosphere there that he was getting out of it anyway, and was able to really convey a very strong sense of place, this small rural community in the Mississippi Delta. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't really know if I want to say that much about the film, yeah, because everything is such a wonderful surprise, you know. But great acting.
By non-professionals. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think the fact that there's no music in the film also is able to let sort of an authenticity of the of that location kind of shine through somehow.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have a favorite of the New Frontier films?
Well, yeah, definitely. The first film I saw at the festival, actually, and I kept waiting for something to beat it, and I don't know if anything ever really did. I mean, Ballast is wonderful, too, in a totally different way. Eat for This Is My Body. It's just a kind of a haunting, poetic. I mean, it's hard to talk about it without using cliches. But it's kind of an interesting mix of. It feels almost documentary in places, but it's such a stylized, you know, personalized universe from this filmmaker Michel-Ange Coué, I think is pronounced his name.
Yeah, I went to see this movie because you were raving about it, and it was amazing. It's from Haiti, and I know so little about Haiti's history that I found that I'm going to have to read up and then go back and revisit the film, but I found that I was responding to the movie sort of cinematically. Like, it made me think of Colossal Youth, Pedro Costa's movie, with this stark color photography, but playing on black and white within this color photography. There's a black hand on white tile, or there's white milk on a black person's face, where there's which is very symbolic in this whole like colonial view of Haiti.
Well, that's what he's definitely playing with, the whole themes of generational legacies of colonialism being passed down to the current day. It starts off with this incredible aerial shot that just swoops over the offshore of, I don't know what city, some city in Haiti.
Yeah.
And then over these shanty towns and then up into the mountains for what it's got to be a very extended shot, and it just keeps going, and but it's playing this music that just makes it soar. I believe it was composed specifically for the film. Then it switches to the breathing of a pregnant mother. And then you see her with her her belly being massaged. And then the next shot after that is a waterfall. Is that her water's breaking? I'm not sure. If this kind of symbolism just sounds like it would infuriate you, maybe it's not for you, but I thought it was great.
It's really hypnotic. It's like 101 minutes, I think, but it flew by. It sort of seems like it isn't going to be the kind of movie that flies by, but if you're really in sync, I think, with it, it does. There were only two people in the screening I went to that stayed through the whole thing. There were a few people who sort of came in and drifted back out.
Huh.
So that was a little disappointing, but it was, some part, it's weird how it has these sort of different modes, like some that are so abstract, they're almost like Matthew Barney or something, with these really large set pieces of liquids and abstraction. But then there are other parts, those are sort of bracketed by these almost ethnographic kind of photography of people and ceremonies, and almost like Jean Rouch or something. There's a short that Jean Rouch made called Les Maîtres Fous, The Mad Masters.
I haven't seen that one.
Which is, I thought of that several times in the movie, because it's about, he's just documenting this ceremony of this tribe in Africa. The ceremony that they have, they eat something and they go into this sort of trance, and their actions that they have after that are like caricatures of colonial behavior. They're like imitating officers, British officers and other, it's really bizarre how that's sort of been incorporated into this traditional ceremony. And so in a lot of ways, the other thing that's interesting about it is that Rouch captures that without any context, so you don't really know what's going on. And this guy Quay does that at the beginning. There's a ceremony, seems sort of religious or something.
It's like a voodoo ceremony.
Yeah, and I don't know enough to know what that was, but I felt sort of the same immersion and what is this? And I feel like there are people who sort of look at the camera sometimes, so they're clearly like just being captured. And then other parts of it are acted by actors in this very choreographed way. So
I don't feel like I've seen any, I mean, I've seen several films about voodoo, and including Maya Deren's film, and this is just one scene in the film, but I don't feel like I ever really felt like I was part of the ceremony before seeing this one. In other films, I felt like I was watching it from observer's point of view.
Yeah. This is like arm's length or two arm's length away from the people involved. Yeah.
And then the other scene, of course, is the one in
the market.
I'm thinking of the priestesses in their white robes.
Oh yeah, yeah.
With their there's four of them, and they're each one of them has got a piece of DJ equipment.
One of them scratching out a turntable. Right. One of them's working the levels. Yeah, someone's got a keyboard.
But yeah, I thought of Matthew Barney, as you mentioned, too. But I like this so much better than Matthew Barney's films, which I feel like are very much caught up in just the scale of what he's pulling off and not so interested in using the camera in interesting ways, or even using the actors in interesting ways. And I really felt like this is just as visionary and personal as a Matthew Barney film, but it felt much more cinematic ultimately, not just at the service of a greater like art project that's going on.
Yeah, I agree. And rooted in a specific place and a specific people and a specific history that I don't think Matthew Barney does either.
Right. Well, yeah, we could argue on that.
I could be wrong, yeah.
maybe Matthew Barney's roots are in the New York art world, and that's where
okay, there we go.
Not quite as interesting as Haiti to
maybe
us.
That's my bias, that's true. The other film that it made me think of at one point was Carlos Regatas's first film, Japón.
Oh, which I've never seen.
There's a shot in Eat for This Is My Body of an old woman in a bed in a very stark room, and there's a prominent character in Regatas's film that is in a similar setup.
I need to catch up with my Regatas. Well, overall, I thought it was a good festival, and I didn't see quite as many documentaries I loved. I enjoyed more of the narrative films and the frontier films. Overall, I'd say it's mostly its greatest success is that it played movies that I was very happy to see, and San Francisco didn't have as quite as good as a lineup
in that particular 10 days in January.
Yeah, for some reason they didn't have as many tempting options.
So do you have 5 or 10 favorites from Sundance?
Okay, I would say if I was going to list 5 or 10, no, let's do 5.
Okay.
I would say Ballast is in the top 5. Eat for This Is My Body is in the top 5. Derek, definitely in the top 5. Baghead, which is a completely different kind of film. Yeah.
Which I also liked, yeah.
That's a film that I don't think anyone should really read about or learn about. They should just see it. And then a fifth one. Well, it feels kind of unfair adding the Edward II, since it's a 1992 film. Yeah. Right.
Let's disqualify that.
So let's disqualify Edward II and say another documentary, Narracoon, which was an excellent documentary about an immigrant family from Laos and their 25-year plus story. The making of the film has taken 25 years. Yeah. And the story, of course, is longer than that.
Immigrants to the U.S.?
Immigrants to the United States, yeah. Mm-hmm. Political refugees from Laos after the communist government took over there.
All right. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob, for inviting me.
And I'm sure I'll see you at the movies.
Okay.
That concludes this edition of the Errata Movie Podcast. If you have feedback, you can send us email at feedback@erratamag.com. That's erratamag.com. You can find this episode and other episodes in this series at www.erratamag.com/podcast. You can also leave a comment there. Or if you'd like to give us a call, call 415-287-4020 and leave a digital voicemail. We'll be back in the next couple of weeks to talk about new movies that are in theaters now or available on DVD. And we have our belated Best of 2007 podcast, which is in the can and coming your way shortly. We'll see you then. Bye.